Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We provide news and reviews about the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more, and we have a great show for you. Again, this week, I'm going to talk to film critic Stephen Garrett about the new movie Fly Me to the Moon, a romantic comedy set in the golden age of NASA. It stars Scarlett Johansson and Channing Tatum and is quite lousy, but it was a lot of fun to talk to Stephen about it, and it'll be a great segment coming up in a little bit. And I'm also going to talk to our contributor Pablo Gallaga about Long Legs, a new serial killer horror movie starring Nicolas Cage. And specifically, Pablo and I are going to discuss whether or not Long Legs is scary and whether or not that matters. And that's based on an article that Pablo wrote for us earlier this week. But first, I'm going to talk to contributor Michael Washburn about the scandal involving the late Canadian Nobel Prize-winning short story author Alice Munro. Some salacious revelations have come out about her life since her death, which was only a few weeks ago. And we're going to talk about controversy and the literary world's reaction to the Alice Munro scandal right after this musical interlude. Just when you thought the literary world was boring and predictable, this summer has seen several major sex scandals rock literary society, global literary society. We have covered all of them on Book and Film Globe. Our contributor Jamie Mason wrote a piece about two recent scandals that erupted online and also in real life. Neil Gaiman, the popular science fiction and fantasy writer, has been accused of some sexual impropriety, to say the least. It's sort of a throwback to the golden era of Me Too, and that is ongoing. But much more tragically and more salaciously, the writer Brandon Dubois, who is a genre writer, and he's contributed and he's collaborated with James Patterson, was caught with a stash of child pornography at his home in Massachusetts and was arrested and turned himself over to authorities. And there's been a lot of blowback from that as well. But perhaps the most salacious of this summer's literary scandals involves the late Alice Munro, the Nobel Prize winning Canadian short story writer, who passed away earlier this summer. And Michael Washburn wrote an obituary, an excellent obituary and evaluation of her work for us. And he's here today to talk to me about what has happened to Alice Munro's reputation since she died. It's been very unpredictable. I did not see this coming. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Neil.
Yeah, so maybe explain a little bit about the story for those of you who haven't been following the Alice Munro saga.
Okay, so Alice Munro, an extremely gifted short story writer, someone say one of the greatest writers in the medium, passed away a few months ago, and she was enormously respected in the world of letters. She was a Nobel laureate. She won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2013. And for a short story writer to win that coveted award is not that common. And that really speaks to her talent. And she was widely regarded as a very fine prose stylist and someone who wrote very engaging stories about relationships and personal drama among families and couples in Canada and especially in her native Ontario. And so she was a tremendously respected writer. And after she died, I wrote an appreciation for Book and Film Globe. And it was one of a number of tributes that appeared after her demise. And little did any of us suspect that after she died, her daughter, Andrea Robin Skinner, would come out with an essay in the Toronto Star saying that she had suffered sexual abuse at the hands of her stepfather, Munro's second husband, Gerald Fremlin. And Ms. Skinner claims that one evening in 1975 or 76, she climbed into bed with her mom, and Gerald Fremlin came into the bed and sexually abused her. And this scarred her for life, and that when she came forward and told her mother about what had happened, Alice Munro inexplicably failed to take action and stayed in a relationship with Gerald Fremlin and carried on.
Well, and these aren't accusations. There was a court case about this, right?
Well, yes. You know, I mean, Miss Skinner pursued this, and you know, she wouldn't drop a bone. And there has been a lot of investigation and testimony, and it's a very, very serious accusation. It's someone that I've dismissed lately, and so she has a very hard time with the fact that after she brought this to the attention of her mom, Alice Munro stayed with this abusive man. And she finds that impossible to accept. And the publication of this essay has had repercussions throughout academia and the world of letters in Canada and the U.S. and beyond.
Right. And, you know, you sent me an article saying that Western University, which is that, I believe, the in Ontario, which is has a literary chair created in Alice Munro's honor, has paused teaching her works.
Well, I think the upshot of the article is that the acting dean, Ileana Paul, is weighing pausing the teaching of Munro's works. Actually, they were going to appoint someone as the Alice Munro Chair in Creativity, but after these revelations come into light, the acting dean is putting a pause on that and saying, maybe we don't want to name someone a chair in a critical liberal arts division while these accusations are floating and people are still weighing how to respond and how to proceed here. So I don't think that they have put that they have canceled this appointment, but they are seriously considering how to proceed here.
Have there been other instances of, I mean, I know there's been a lot of chatter and blather on social media about this this subject, but I mean, have there been other instances of Alice Munro being canceled, I guess, for lack of a better term?
Well, on a university level, with regard to courses and appointments, I'd have to get back to you on that, but her reputation is definitely in peril, and there's this huge online firestorm, and people are weighing whether she deserves to have this Nobel Prize. And actually, if you read the article that I forwarded to you, it's kind of interesting. There's this quotation at the end, and there's so much recrimination and back and forth, and says, Menina Jones, an English professor, has taught Munro's work for many years. I'm quoting here from this article, and praises her as a master of the short story, but weighs whether to go on teaching her literature in English courses. And then Jones said in an interview with CBC's London Morning that she is thinking of going forward teaching Munro, but she may include a disclaimer about the problematic nature of Alice Munro's personal life and the fact that Munro failed to take appropriate action in the face of these accusations. And
I mean, it's one thing to mention it, right? Obviously, it's hard to talk about Alice Munro going forward without talking about this story, but I don't know. I mean, they're really talking about taking away her Nobel Prize. There's actual talk of that posthumously removing the Nobel Prize, her name from the prize. That's just insane to me that they would even consider that. I mean, I don't think, you know, no one's going to condone covering up the sexual abuse of your own daughter. I mean, that's, you know, it is morally problematic to say the least. Mm-hmm. But isn't it ironic that, you know, Alice Munro, the bard of morally problematic ordinary Canadians, has her own morally problematic and probably extremely complicated scenario that we'll never really know what went into her thought process. You know, I mean, I just don't understand this impulse to what virtue are we seeking by trying to not teach a writer of the short story who I think you and I both agree is was as gifted and skilled and subtle as Alice Munro. I don't understand why you would even consider not teaching that if you were already teaching it.
The thing about Alice Munro is that she was really interested in problematic characters, troubled protagonists. If you read her short stories, she tends to write about very damaged people. And I think that as an author, she had a place in her heart for people who were deeply flawed, but who were trying to find their way in the world and trying to do some good. And her tendency, her general inclination was not to write people off because they faced an accusation of having done something bad. And she wanted to find the good in people. She wanted to appreciate people in all their complexity. And if they had any redeeming qualities, that was something that she really tended to try to highlight along with their flaws. And, some of her protagonists are old couples in small towns in Ontario, or people in relationships that are falling apart, or residents of nursing homes. And suddenly someone moves into the nursing home who is, has a health problem and also has a deeply conflicted personal history. And Munro asks, well, can we find some good in this person? Can we find some redeeming trait, anything at all that would prevent us from just writing the person off? And so She may have been in this relationship with this abusive man, but look, she was aware of the gulfs of loneliness and desolation that faced people in their later years. And was she just going to say, well, my daughter doesn't like my second husband, should I just get rid of him and never speak to him again? And where would that leave me? So she was very much aware of the complexity of human relationships and the human condition. And maybe she didn't go as rough on her second husband as her daughter wanted, but look, she was a fiction writer, and sometimes I think we have just childish expectations of writers, and we expect them to be not only consummate craftspeople and artists, but also to be angels in their personal lives.
Well, here's the thing. Claire Dederer, the memoirist, wrote a book last year about the monstrous past of a lot of the literary writers who she admires. Mm-hmm. And the ones she discussed were all men, all of whom had been accused of, spousal abuse or murder. There's a whole, abusive behavior, all kinds. They were all men. Her conclusion was, you can separate the art from the artist. And I feel like, at the very least, we should, it's not like Alice Munro was accused of sexually abusing her daughter herself. I feel like we should be able afford her the same runway to be able to consider this. I mean, I know we're in an era where we're not allowed to like the work of anybody who has done something disagreeable. I know you and I are of the same voice here when I'm saying, I think we really need to try to find it in our brains to do that in this case, because it's just absurd that that Canadian universities wouldn't be teaching the works of perhaps the greatest writer to ever come out of Canada.
Well, I think all too often, people who think this way don't really consider the implications of the course that they propose. As I said before, I think sometimes they have childish expectations of writers, and they don't think about Beethoven, who allegedly threw his plate across the room when he didn't like his meal, or Hemingway, who had all these problems with alcoholism and a very oafish personality. And how far are you going to take this? Do progressives want to forswear Martin Luther King because of alleged improprieties in his personal life? And you can say, well, look, there's so much about his life and work and legacy that outweighs any human failings that he may have had. Exactly. We're quickly getting to a point where you can't even make that argument because we have, you know, there are these childish expectations, and you have to be both a master artist and an angel in your personal life. Otherwise, no one will ever, you know, people will cancel you and will never give you another thought.
Let he or she who is without sin cast the first stone. That's what I say. Anyway, Michael Washburn wrote about the Alice Munro controversy for us in Book and Film Globe. And I thank you always, Michael, for your excellent coverage of the literary world and for your insight into these matters. And I will talk to you very soon.
My pleasure. Thank you, Neil.
Our movie of the week, or at least a movie of a week, is Fly Me to the Moon, directed by, who directed that thing? Some director, written by
Greg Berlanti.
Creator.
The Kubrick of Dawson's Creek.
Oh yeah, and I think he also had his hand in the CW's Arrowverse, a lot of those DC shows. It stars Scarlett Johansson and Channing Tatum in a meet cute surrounding the Apollo moon landing in 1969. And Stephen Garrett reviewed it for us, and he is here today.
Hello.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello. Hello. I was excited for this, man.
Were you?
I love a good rom-com, and I love space stuff, and I love the 60s and NASA. So
yes.
I was definitely looking forward to it.
I don't hate a good rom-com, and I definitely love the 60s and NASA. And there have been so many good movies and TV shows about the 60s and NASA, which we'll get to in a little bit. You know, there's The Right Stuff, and not the Disney remake, the original movie, The Right Stuff. The show For All Mankind on Apple Plus, the Apollo 11 documentary film that came out. And, you know, and while you were higher on Damien Chazelle's First Man than I am, still, you know, it's definitely a real movie.
And then what was HBO had From the Earth to the Moon? Was that?
There was From the Earth to the Moon. There was also Apollo 13. I mean, there have been a lot of good sort of.
I mean, I Dream of Jeannie. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Sure, for
That was the original rom-com based in 1960s NASA.
I don't know if it was the space stuff that you liked about I Dream of Jeannie, Stephen. But anyway, the genie in this movie, Fly Me to the Moon, is Scarlett Johansson. She's not a genie. She's like a mad woman. She's a PR person from Madison Avenue who ends up getting recruited by a shadowy government operative played poorly by Woody Harrelson. I mean, I don't know if he's played poorly, but it's not like
he's phoning in the shadowy operative.
I
feel like Woody Harrelson's very familiar performance from Woody.
Yeah, he wasn't exactly flexing his Oscar chops in this one, anyway. But this Woody Harrelson, who plays a ridiculous character, comic book character, basically recruits Scarlett Johansson to. Give NASA a little PR bump. And I guess this was based on an article or a book or something. I can see like selling NASA as being a premise. But then she goes to Florida where Apollo 11 is going to launch. And she becomes romantically entangled with Channing Tatum, who is an ex-Korean War pilot who has been entrusted with being in charge of the launch of Apollo 11. And, you know, what I thought was funny about Channing Tatum in this movie was, well, first of all the other NASA engineers, and there's dozens and dozens of them, are all wearing white shirt, button-down shirts and ties. And Channing... Channing Tatum is wearing these technicolored polo shirts, you know, that he can barely fit into. His muscles are still so bulging from Magic Mike, The Last Dance, or whatever the hell that thing was. And it reminded me of those movies where you're expected to believe that Tara Reid or Megan Fox is a nuclear physicist. I mean, Channing Tatum is a himbo. That is his, right? Am I wrong about that? Come on.
He can be. He's a bit of a himbo. I think he's a thinking man's himbo.
I mean, he's fine. He's nice to look at. And
they both are.
Scarlett Johansson looks lovely in this film, and they give her lots of fun costumes, clothing to wear. Her assistant, she has a 20-something assistant who also wears lots of cute clothes. You know, and I'm like, what is wrong with me? I'm like literally focusing on the main two female characters' outfits.
Isn't that a tell? I mean, isn't that obviously like the movie is not cooking if you're focusing on the outfits? If the outfits are more interesting than the characters in the movie, yeah, then
you know. And here's the thing, like, you know,
which they were,
yeah, exactly. Like the plot is, you know, it's ridiculous. It's like, you know, the whole idea is that Woody Harrelson's character, and this doesn't even happen till the second half of the movie. There's a whole half of a movie that's just this boring setup. Woody Harrelson's character forces Scarlett Johansson to fake the moon landing in a hangar on the grounds of where they're launching Apollo 11, and somehow no one ever discovers it. They're just building a whole
even
moon.
Worse. I mean, look, you brought up the original sin of the movie, which is here it is 1968, and it's never occurred to NASA that they need to market themselves to the public,
which is ridiculous.
Well,
it's a bunch of nonsense.
10 years to
and
do
then
that.
They need to convince these senators to give NASA funding in like 5 months before the Apollo 11 launch. And I'm like, oh, are they just gonna scrap it? They're just gonna scrap the moon launch. And not only that, the set. I mean, I know it wasn't Mission Control in Houston, but it looked like a the set from Disney's Mission to Mars. That these the car, yeah. I mean, it was. I'm just like, so the whole thing where there's a scene where Channing Tatum and Scarlett Johansson fly to Louisiana to convince this senator that to do Apollo 11. He's a fundamentalist Christian senator, and Channing Tatum appeals to the Jesusness of this guy.
Pushes the Jesus buttons, yeah.
Pushes the Jesus buttons, and that's why Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins went into space. It's just so stupid. You know, especially, okay, so let's get back to this, right? I mean, I know that you're not a fan, or you're not a follower of For All Mankind. You would be a fan if you would.
I'm aware of it.
If you would take the 50 hours out of your life to watch it.
I think that's the problem there. It's just there are enough hours.
I had 50 hours to spare this year. I time banked them earlier in my life, and I watched all of For All Mankind, which admittedly like goes, you know, eventually they end up on Mars. That's not relevant to this movie, but the first couple of episodes are about the early days of the moon program, and they're so good, and they're so gripping, and they're so detailed, and they're so grounded in detail of what NASA was really like. And
well, and that's the thing, and I mean the right stuff. Yes. You know, the book and the movie both prove that there is enough craziness, hilarity, unbelievability, drama, you know, human interest. Like it can be funny and shocking and like outrageous and
heartfelt. Dramatic.
You know, it can do all the feelings.
And romantic. The Right Stuff has a lot of romance in it, and so does For All Mankind. For All Mankind almost has too much. It almost became like a telenovela set in space, which is, you know, a problem with the show. But at least like the relationships felt like they had stakes, and you know, the women were astronauts in For All Mankind, which was something that the show did that wouldn't even occur to Fly Me to the Moon, where the women were just these like cute PR people, you know, and you know, and the Right Stuff, the women were not going into space because it was actual reality, but those wife characters, you know, Barbara Hershey and Pamela Reed and some of the other characters had so much depth and agency, and you know, look, the Right Stuff's like my favorite movie, pretty much.
No, but the thing is, I think also it's basically, I'm trying to be sympathetic to Fly Me to the Moon because I there were times where I really was enjoying it, and it just seemed so deeply, deeply, deeply misguided and uninformed, and like a movie made by people who really didn't understand or care to know enough about the space program for people who would come in with literally zero knowledge about the space program, so they wouldn't, you know, challenge the ideas and the conceits that they're putting in front of them, right? You know, like this is made by people who are really ignorant of the space program for people who are totally ignorant of the space program.
You know, and it's just like there were still rocket launches, and they even talked about Gus Grissom burning up in the cabin, and apparently it was Channing Tatum's fault.
Apparently, it was totally chance.
And, for some, and despite that, he kept his job and all of his shirts.
he got promoted to launch director. He is the big cheese.
Right.
He is the boss.
Even though
of the room.
His carelessness was the reason that Gus Grissom is dead. It just makes no sense. And it's like, oh, and he's taking care of Gus Grissom's grave. He's planting flowers at it every day. And I'm just like, what is this? What are we watching? And then there is this sort of the weird, Madison Avenue stuff too. Like, I mean, I know that you did not like Jerry Seinfeld's On Frosted.
No,
that's fine.
God.
Mileage may vary on that kind of humor, but there was a great satire of Mad Men in the show. You know, Don Draper and Roger Sterling from Mad Men show up in On Frosted to try to sell the Pop-Tart, and it's hilarious. You didn't get to that part, but I'm like, and so it just reminded you of how amazing Mad Men was, and then you're revisiting it.
Well, that's very, and it's weird. Like, okay, it's a funny comparison, right? Because I think Unfrosted is made by people who lived through it, or certainly one specific person named Jerry Seinfeld who lived through that. And this is his wacky homage to that. So you like, for people who are younger, you're not going to get half the jokes that he's making about whether it's Mad Men or The Right Stuff or whatever. But at least he's doing informed jokes, right? As opposed to this movie, which is like, so uninformed. That's my big beef.
Yeah, really. I mean, the
Airheads.
Yeah, it was really dumb. And, and they staged the moon landing on a soundstage on the grounds of the launch center for Apollo 11, and nobody found out about it. And then when they did find out about it, they were like, oh, okay, we'll just make the best of it. And that ridiculous director character played by Jim Rath, who admittedly was very funny.
Right.
To watch. He was, he's...
It's a very Tony Randall, Paul Lynn type.
Yeah, I'm like, all right, well, you just set gay rights back 100 years, right? with this Queenie character. At least they mentioned that he had a boyfriend. He was certainly not a closeted gay man in 1968, which would have made him the only one.
Exactly.
Pretty much, like, he's just out, out and proud queen, drinking tab on the set. It was just so, everything about this movie annoyed me, again, because, I love that period of history and those stories, and I just don't, look, and this movie's a huge flop.
It's a huge flop. People are not enjoying
it. Yeah.
I mean,
with good reason. So, you were very generous to give this 3 stars. We don't do halvesies.
We don't do halvesies. Exactly. We don't do halvesies. I wouldn't have given it 2. I mean, I can understand. Like, I hate dinging a movie because I'm infuriated by the factual inconsistencies. I try to look at a movie the way that somebody who doesn't know anything about the story is watching the movie, and would they be entertained? My big ding is that, like, the story doesn't make sense in a lot of ways that you pointed out. Also, it's over 2 hours long. Come on, guys.
2 hours.
If you're going to do this, like, make it short and sweet.
2 hours and 15 minutes long.
Yeah, make it 1 hour 40. Like, at least respect your audience enough to cut
pace. Because they couldn't hone in on the will they, won't they romance enough. There was all this other nonsense going.
But there were times, wouldn't you admit, that the beginning, I thought they were really cooking in terms of dialogue. It's very sassy. It was a very screwball
first
comedy,
half hour.
The way that Scarlett Johansson kind of maneuvered through her world and her life, and their meet cute in the bar. And, I don't know. There were parts where I was very charmed, and then I got a little bored, and then I got irritated.
The first half hour was fine, but then when they brought in the fake moon landing, I was just like, what in the world? What are we doing here? Why even? It's odd. Like, I literally have no idea how or why this movie got made. It's very strange.
Because Apple had a lot of money, and they were like, sure, let's do it. Rom-com space. Well, look, it's Apple, and Apple has for
yeah,
all my
they have
time,
a leftover
right?
rockets to blow up or whatever.
Yeah, why not? There were some times where the footage in the movie is the same footage that NASA shot in 70mm that was from their archive that is in that superior documentary, Apollo 11. That has.
All right. So here's what if you're listening to this in the United States, in the Gambia, in Albania, in Hong Kong, in all the places that this show is amazingly popular, if you're interested in the U.S. space program, watch For All Mankind if you can find it. See The Right Stuff every day for the rest of your life. Apollo 11, Apollo 13, even First Man. Like, you love First Man. I don't love First Man because I don't like it when astronauts cry. I don't like...
They're not allowed to cry?
I don't like it when astronauts cry on the moon. Although there's a lot of astronauts crying on the moon in For All Mankind. But it's because, like, they're breaking their arms and stuff. So there's reasons for them to be crying. Not because they're sad, but because they're, like, they're crazy or injured or something.
Oh, yeah. And you didn't like Ad Astra, right?
Ad Astra. Oh, God, no. I liked the buggy chase on the moon.
Oh, that buggy chase on the moon is great. What about the crazy chimpanzee?
All right, fine. I just didn't like the tone. Like, it just didn't have the tone for me. It was the two.
You don't like sad astronauts.
I don't like sad astronauts.
Sad astronauts.
Which is odd because there's a lot of sad astronauts in For All Mankind. But
where do you stand on Space 1999? Because that is dynamite.
I mean, that's a long time ago, Stephen. I just
A Dream of Jeannie.
I just remember it scaring the hell out of me.
It's pretty.
You know, there's some scary stuff. There's like people's faces melting and like weird alien.
Martin Landau. Martin Landau. Come on.
Barbara Bain in a very tight jumpsuit.
Barbara Bain. Very tight. Amazing. It's got one of the best theme songs too.
Agreed. All right. So Space Night.
This is how good Fly Me to the Moon is because it's just making us talk about.
It's making us talk about Space 1999. That's Fly Me to the Moon. It will be on Apple shortly for you to ignore or to watch the first half hour of. Stephen Garrett, I have to go get ready to launch our next moon mission.
Roger that.
There's going to be a wacky misunderstanding. All right, over and out.
Over and out.
The surprise hit movie of the moment, maybe even of the summer, although there have been a couple of surprises this summer, is Long Legs, a serial killer movie starring Nicolas Cage as a serial killer. I know you're like, doesn't Nicolas Cage always play a serial killer? But he doesn't actually always play a serial killer. He plays characters who could always seem like they could become serial killers at any moment. And Pablo Gallaga wrote about Long Legs. He didn't review it for us. He wrote about the discourse around Long Legs, about people are discussing whether or not this movie is scary and if that matters. And Pablo is here today to talk to me about whether or not Long Legs is scary. Hello, Pablo.
Hey, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, as you know, I don't like scary movies much. I see an occasional horror film here or there, but only if there's some comedy or big ideas involved. And so I have not seen Long Legs. I count on you to let me know whether stuff is scary or not. And your piece was a lot of fun because you kind of came to the conclusion that it really doesn't matter. And then maybe we should stop trying to talk about this like we're 8 years old.
Yeah, it's something that, over the last few years, and I think part of it obviously is like the marketing hype that happens just around film and entertainment in general these days. If you look back as recently as like last year or the year before, you had films like When Evil Lurks that, is supposed to kind of blow the doors off of people, Talk to Me, Skinamarink. And I mean, if you're somebody who's a horror fan like myself, I just don't get scared by films anymore. And it's not like a thing that I boast about. And there are, in my piece, like I talk about, there's people that do boast about that and it's supposed to be like a badge of honor or whatever. But no, I mean, to me, there's no bearing on whether, if it's a scary film, if that means it's a good film, like that those things can, be separated.
Well, I also I feel like the boundaries have kind of blurred, right? Like I saw Maxine a couple of weeks ago, and I saw people marketing that as a horror movie, and I'm like, that was not a horror movie. That was a thriller, like an erotic thriller.
Yeah, yeah, the pastiche of like 80s kind of sleaze and all that. Yeah, it's technically a horror film, but yeah, I see what you're saying.
Technically, there's some splatter. There's definitely some serial killing in it for sure. But I just like. To me, when I think of horror movies, I think of monsters. I think of aliens bursting out of people's stomachs. I think of ghosts. I guess in a sense, like Friday the 13th. Those are sort of supernatural elements to them that wasn't in Maxine. So my question is: so isn't Long Legs like a serial killer movie along the lines of Silence of the Lambs? Again, I haven't seen it because it sounded scary. And also it kind of took me by surprise. I'm like, it suddenly came out of nowhere and was this huge hit.
Yeah, it's definitely taking cues from Silence of the Lambs, Seven, Zodiac. So it is a FBI procedural serial killer film. I don't want to give much away, but I would categorize it as horror, definitely. It's both those things.
Okay, so people called Silence of the Lambs a horror movie, but I never considered it that.
It's thriller. I consider it a thriller.
Yeah, I know. I certainly don't consider the other movies you mentioned. Seven is not a horror movie. Zodiac is definitely not a horror movie at all. So, but Long Legs is. It's more monstrous, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is if we do talk about Zodiac and Seven, like when I think back to the first times I saw those films, like those got my heart rate up. Like I don't think I've ever been as scared as when I was watching the basement scene in Zodiac. So to say that it's not a horror film and it's probably scared me more than most horror films, like that says something, right? Like there's a separation then from the genre of whether scary actually matters.
I mean, I consider Zodiac to be just like kind of a really good historical drama about the obsession with trying to find a serial killer. And you could say the same thing about, especially the first season of the Netflix show Mindhunter.
Yeah.
Right? Sure, there are there's some tense, scary moments in that. But again, it's not horror film. Like when I, growing up, like I considered a horror film to be like, you know, a guy stabbing people.
Slasher, yeah.
Yeah, a guy or you know, a crazy doll killing people or, you know, like I can, but I guess you're right. Like as I've grown older, like things are, like for instance, like I guess you could qualify Megan as a horror movie.
Definitely.
But yeah. I was not scared by Megan.
Exactly. You know? And that's surprising. Like you get scared, don't you, easily by horror films? Like that's why you avoid them?
I get scared by werewolves. By werewolves.
Specifically werewolves, yeah.
Specifically, because I found my tolerance growing in recent years. Like I've been able to watch Ari Aster movies. I've been able to sat through Barbarian and enjoyed it. And those are definitely monster horror movies. But I have found that my tolerance has grown as I've grown older. And I think that's one of the things that this discourse is talking about, right? Like we need to stop being afraid of the dark. I'm in my 50s, you know, you're not in your 50s, but you will be, you know, because you seem to have a strong heart for these kinds of movies. So, you know, I don't know, like, again, like in recent years, it feels like every other movie that comes out is in the horror genre. So maybe we need to sort of reconsider what that actually means.
Yeah, and as I argued in the piece, you know, it comes down to audience as anything does and the individual. I find, you know, as we're saying, as you get older, it kind of changes what scares you. And going back to Zodiac and Seven, like I think the realism there and looking back at something that actually happened in Zodiac, like that terrifies me more than, you know, a ghost in the dark that's not going to happen. So... yeah, I think when we talk
except
about...
except for werewolves. Werewolves are real.
Those remember. Are real. That will happen. And
thank you for admitting it finally. All right, so I guess before we sign off today, is Long Legs worth seeing? Because we didn't really review it in the publication. And more importantly, did you find it scary?
The first question, yes, it is worth seeing. I think there's going to be a lot of conversation around it. Not... necessarily because of the quality of the film, but there's just, you know, some of the dialogue in it is the type of things that are like almost like earworms. Like people are going to keep repeating some of the phrases from it. One of the concepts in the film is that the killer is specifically targeting, you know, young girls whose birthday is on the 14th of the month. So, I mean, that's just something that's going to live on. Like that will live on, and people will always point to people with birthdays on the 14th because of this film.
Because the film has this iconic, it's starting to take on this iconic vibe.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, this horror fans saw it coming. Oz Perkins has that kind of pedigree, obviously, you know, son of Anthony Perkins. And he, you know, this is not him bursting onto the scene. He cut his teeth with The Black Coat's Daughter in 2015. I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House and the Gretel and Hansel movie. So yeah, I think he's making a name.
All right, it's not his first movie, but it's his first mainstream hit.
It's first smash hit, I would say, where people kind of know who he is now and are going to be looking out for him the way people look out for Jordan Peele.
Really, it's that significant.
I think it will be. There's obviously going to be some, you know, debate, but again, going back to whether it's scary or not. For me, I mean, like I say, horror films don't scare me. I think it's going to scare a general audience.
All right. Well, you are immune to all fear, and good for you. I may have to, you know, creep out and see Long Legs at some point.
Yeah,
maybe
check
if
it
I
out.
Go to it. Maybe if I go. Yeah. Maybe if I mean, I think I can handle it. If I can handle the other movies that I was mentioning, you think I'll be all right here?
Yeah. Yeah. No. If you could handle those, you're good.
All right. Good enough. All right. Well, Long Legs may or may not be scary, depending on your tolerance for such things, but it comes recommended by our horror film expert, Pablo Gallaga. Thank you so much, and just do me a favor and just stay off the roads when the moon is full. That's all I care about. I want to look after my contributors.
Will do. Thanks, Neil.
All right. Thank you, Pablo Gallaga. Long Legs is in theaters now, burning up the box office, scaring and not scaring people all over the world. Also, thank you to Stephen Garrett for stopping in to talk to me about Fly Me to the Moon and about other better movies set in the golden age of NASA. And thanks to Michael Washburn for talking to me about the Alice Munro scandal. It's a crazy story. There's a lot of crazy stories involving literary figures this summer, and we've covered all or most of them on Book and Film Globe. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the world of books and film and streaming TV and much more, and I will talk to you soon. Audio
Original Production.